Welcome to Where You're At, a podcast that highlights the work of alumni from the Journalism and Media Studies Department at San Diego State University. I'm Pete Frank Williams. Our goal is to share the success of alums, inspire current students with these stories, and connect students and alums for mentoring. And now, here's your host, Josh Shushan.
This week on the Where You At podcast, we are heading to Minneapolis, Minnesota. This week, we're talking sports journalism. In particular, we're talking baseball. Our guest is Dan Hayes. He has covered Major League Baseball for 17 years now. He's a proud SDSU alum. He got his start at the Daily Aztec, and he's taken a break from spring training so that we can talk to him about his career and what it's like covering baseball. Welcome, Daniel, to the Where You At podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Josh. Soosh. What's up, man?
Yeah. All right. So this will probably not be a very formal podcast since Dan and I have known each other for a very long time. Our paths crossed a lot through Major League Baseball press boxes, and Dan's one of my good friends. So it's always fun when you get to have a podcast with one of your good friends. But let me start here, Dan. You've covered baseball for 17 years. You cover the Padres, you cover the White Sox, now you cover the Twins. But it's been three totally different philosophies of writing. I want you to go into the details about this, but you're at the North County Times, kind of more traditional newspaper coverage, game story, notebook. Then you were at Comcast Chicago, which is a regional sports network that just puts sports on TV, but you put a lot of content, stories, video. You did some live hits for their website. And now you write for The Athletic, which is a paid subscription. It's about detailed feature stories. So go into more detail now that I've set you up for the three different types of ways that you've covered Major League Baseball.
Yeah, the North County Times was definitely just traditional and daily beat coverage, right? When I started, Twitter wasn't really even, I think it was my third season that Twitter sort of became a thing. So imagine like what that world was like. You know, at the time I started, MLB trade rumors had sort of just come to prominence, and essentially they were collecting newspaper headlines, and like you were still like waking up the next day and finding out what your competitors wrote, which is just an absolutely insane world. I mean, I know there was online websites and stuff like that, but you know, 2007 from 2023, it's a totally different ball game. And so like, it was very simple. It was go to the ball game, find some interesting stuff for your notebook and find a good angle for your game story. And there you go. That's it. Maybe you do a radio interview occasionally, but that was like all of the entirety of the job at the time. And as it grew, like, you know, 2010, Twitter came to prominence and, you know, the Padres were relevant for the first time in a couple of years. And so social media was fun to kind of learn and go along with. But I mean, it really didn't change much. And then you go to the next place, which was, it's now NBCSN Chicago. It was Comcast Chicago back then. And it, to cover the White Sox. And I left in the middle of the 2012 season from the Padres. And I mean, that was a total change, just 100%, because I was on air for TV like significantly, and I had zero experience whatsoever. I had an internship in San Diego at Fox 6 right around the time of 9/11. I did one semester working with Katie Temple and Todd Helmer and a bunch of people there, and it was a really great experience, but I had no TV whatsoever. And all of a sudden I'm doing talkbacks frequently, doing some stuff for the web and very active on social media, just entirely different writing for a website. You know, not having a newspaper be part of your product for the first time in my career. And my first job in journalism was at the Vallejo Times Herald in 2003. So I'd been a newspaper guy for, you know, 10 years at that point. And all of a sudden there's no more finding the copy of your story on, you know, in a newspaper form. That was so strange and surreal, but it was a really cool job. I mean, like after a while, it was clear I was okay on talkbacks and stuff like that, they started having me doing some sideline stuff. And that was a total disaster, being a sidelines guy. Just throw someone who's a newspaper person into sideline reporting. That doesn't work well, but we've kind of found a happy medium, which was that I then instead would go to the booth during the game for an in-between, like an in-innings hit. And I'd sit between the announcers, who at the time were Ken Harrelson, Hawk Harrelson, and Steve Stone. And then Jason Benetti eventually became the White Sox TV guy. But I would go in for an inning and talk about the news of the day. And we'd break up the broadcast. And it was probably twice a week. And it was a lot of fun. And it was totally out of my comfort zone. And I did that for 6 years. I had a great time with it. I then got to be part of a media business. Everybody gets their turn, laid off. You know, they laid off everybody in our digital department in the right after the 2017 season. And I was really fortunate that The Athletic was just opening up a bunch of markets. They had been established in Chicago already, maybe Toronto and Cleveland at the time, and had just started the Bay Area. But really, it was very much in its early days, and there were a bunch of beat openings available. And I really liked Minnesota. I had a great time going up there and was willing to switch to that because we still have a great White Sox writer, James Fegan, who was one of my really closest friends. And I wasn't going to replace him. Like he did a great job and had started to build an audience, and they're like very happy with his work. So it was like, we want you on board, but we don't have, you know, openings in Chicago. So what do you think? And I was like, all right, Milwaukee, no, St. Louis, Pittsburgh, like Minnesota seemed the best for like a great fit for me, with the exception of spring training for Minnesota being in Florida. It's been a lot of fun for the last 6 years. And yeah, it is. It's back to being, it's closer to newspaper reporting. Obviously, it's for the website. You have to promote your stuff on social media, but it's combining the elements of reporting that I was doing back in the newspaper days. And I was still doing them in Chicago, but Chicago is a lot of one source stories, get a headline, get a flashy headline, and not do in-depth reporting. And this is so different than that. This is encouraging you to get 6-7 sources for stories and really dive into it and find the best angle and go from there and take time with it. And I love that kind of journalism. You know, storytelling is what we're supposed to do. And I feel like this place gets it and doesn't expect such a quick turnaround. And it allows you to tell a really good story versus shoveling a lot of garbage. I'll go with the edited version there. Shoveling a lot of garbage from over the years that you get when you want, you know, a place that wants quick turnaround and not as in-depth reporting.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's really interesting. I think this is really important for students to understand. You know, I was just on campus not too long ago. I got to talk with a bunch of different professors, including Noah Arsenault, and great conversation with Noah. And he told me about how many journalists, student journalists these days really want to get into sports. And then we started to discuss, and I want to get into this with you, Dan, is just the importance of knowing all of the different types of mediums, knowing what it's like to write a 2,000, 5,000 word story, but also sometimes you just got to get one source and put something out there, depending, just knowing what your employer wants, what that philosophy is, and then being able to execute that.
It takes a lot of like, I don't know. I mean, it's experience, you know, and my first newspaper in Vallejo, where we were on our own, like there were four of us in sports, but it was a smaller place. And you learn real quick that you are the person that gets everything. You get the stats for your high school football game. You get, you know, you determine how good of a reporter basically you are. And the key is always just keep wanting to add, regardless of where you work, honestly. Like even in Chicago, when it was the one source place, I would get more and I would try to build the stories out. Like we had a rule at the North County Times that every story, even if it was a notebook for 500 words, needed to have three sources. And I feel like that's sort of a key. Hey, look, somebody could tell you, you know, Josh, you could tell me you signed with the Minnesota Twins, a 4-year, $100 million deal. And if you're the player, I guess I can trust you and run with that. But honestly, I probably need to talk to a couple more people. And like, it's been, I just feel like that's something that just comes with time and building sources out and always talking to more people, regardless of where you are. I just feel like the Chicago experience was great, but you can't let it, like even in that medium where it was one source, get a headline out. You really can turn yourself into a pretty dumb reporter by not talking to people. And I think that's just the key to this, is just constantly talking to more and more people and finding out what the real story is and not settling for the quick one. Because I mean, yes, of course, in a breaking news situation, there are times where you have to absolutely do it. I still now turn around notebooks where it's maybe three or four items and maybe you only get one person per item. But at the same time, I want to try and talk to as many people as possible because you get background. You get so much detailed stuff that you can't just – you make your reader smarter. You know what I mean? And that's important to me is – adding detail, depth to stories. I don't know. It's just sort of reporting 101. Talk to more people. Don't settle for the quick, easy thing, regardless of what you do, because I feel like you shortchange not just your reader, but you shortchange yourself as a reporter. And that's important.
I just wrote down that phrase, make your reader smarter. I really like that. Make your reader smarter. The other thing, and I wrote this question down, and I wrote like half serious, half joking, but the more I think about it, the more serious I am. In terms of, in order to cover sports nowadays, you have to cover competitive balance taxes and payroll and funding for stadiums and TV contracts and how a regional TV network might go bankrupt and then what that means for the money coming in for the team. How much important is it for students, for reporters to not just have a basic understanding of finance, but to have a pretty detailed nuance of finances with the amount of money that's involved in sports these days?
I mean, I think it is. It just depends on your situation. I'm really lucky. I work at The Athletic and we have a lot of good national reporters. So I don't necessarily have to dive into that myself. We have Evan Drellick. We have Ken Rosenthal. We have all these people who are covering it at a national level because it is such a national issue. I mean, when you're talking about 18 teams whose RSNs potentially could be going under, that seems a little bit tricky. And it's a big picture kind of topic, and we are one of them, and I keep up on it on the local level for sure because it'd be silly not to, but I'm not reporting directly as much. But you can't go into it without understanding all that stuff. I think the key is when it's not a strong suit, and I'm not gonna pretend like it is, you look at sources like Forbes, which releases its national or its annual team evaluations and stuff like that, and learn to find information. Always learn to find someone smarter than you, which is not hard when it comes to that stuff, and get a bigger picture. And I think that like when you cover a team or an organization, you know, it's not just a finance. You need to be willing to dive into the business side a little bit, but you need to be willing to dive into their minor leagues. You cover the whole organization. Yes, it's clear I cover the Minnesota Twins Major League Baseball team, and that's my primary goal, but I cover the entire organization. So you look at their international operations, you just uncover different things. There's two reasons to do this. One, you gain a lot more sources, people who are going to tell you what's going on with the organization when you dive into every area that they cover. And that's a great thing to have because you don't want to just have the people at the top be your only sources, because then you can be misled, I think. And the thing I always tell people is, look, I just don't want to look dumb. I really don't want to look dumb when it comes to this story. So shoot me straight. And the more people you can have that shoot you straight, the better. And that means branching out and covering the business side a little bit and, you know, knowing the finances. But I mean, there's so many things you have to grasp covering a team and you can't really just blow it off. I mean, I am, like I said, I am lucky that I can, in the case with the Bally's RSN problem, turn to some more veteran people. But, you know, at the same time, you have to at least have a grasp of what's going on because there's so much that's critical to a team's budget every year and how that plays into it. The one thing that is unfortunate is that because baseball doesn't open its books, we don't get the full picture. And so you're sort of working with a half picture as it is. It's difficult. I think the Cardinals make like $70 million annually off their Bally's deal. But what does that mean, right? Like what else, what's their revenue? And I know Forbes can tell you a little bit, like maybe they make $400 million annually. Only teams I think we have a real true picture of are the Blue Jays and the Braves, because they're both owned by cable companies who have to open their books and let everyone know. And that's a good glimpse, but it would be great to know what the Twins make and how much they should be spending. We don't have that full picture. And so you kind of have to take it, not pretend to be a total expert with it, because that's where you can look dumb very easily.
Speaking of looking dumb, I want to talk about the importance of not being a fanboy or being a fangirl. And I bring this up, I saw this on Twitter, and I don't want to put this person on blast, but it was someone who was working in a local market, and it was not this reporter's day to work. And this reporter took a photo. I want to make sure that I don't use he or she so that I don't indicate that. Took a photo of themselves with the gear on of the team that they cover and tweeted out, "Can't wait to go see this team and cheer for this team tonight." And my head was about to explode. I couldn't believe that someone was going to do that. And that's just one example. And I feel like sometimes with social media, it's really easy to get caught up and, oh, this is an easy way to get likes and retweets and to build my following and things like that. But going to a baseball game as a reporter, you're not just eating hot dogs and drinking beer and being there as a fan. I mean, you're there to work. And so what are some of your best tips about not being a fanboy and making sure that you stay objective, even though most of the readers want the Twins to win who are reading you? And so, you know, and you're around them, but yet it's not your job to make them better or to help them win.
That is a huge thing. I mean, honestly, one thing, I don't cover the team you loved growing up. I mean, unless you're willing to dismiss them entirely and give up, you know, in my case, there's no way I could do that. I'm too sentimental when it comes to the Giants. The San Francisco Giants, I at this point probably could cover the Giants much easier than early on. But I mean, it would have been tough at first. There's no question about that. That's why I've enjoyed covering the Padres, the White Sox, the Twins. And you're right. My readership is better when the Twins are good. You know, people are actually very much into it. It doesn't mean, however, that I should be cheering for them. So you just kind of have to keep it at arm's length. Well, one, it's really easy these days not to cheer for a team anyways. Like, I find myself rooting for players that I like covering far more than anything at that point. And you always root for a good story. That's fine. But even that, sometimes you're like, oh, man, maybe I shouldn't be like, this is great for the clicks if this guy does well. But at the same time, you know, that you sort of get to that blurry lines area. And I just think that it's easy to get caught up when you are attached. And so you kind of have to keep that arm's length. But at the same time, you want to be close to these guys because they are your sources. You know, you have to find that line between being too much friendly and critical. And I think that there's an easy way to do that. I don't like personally to take cheap shots. I know writers who do. They love the good line. They'll get a reader to laugh. Cool. That's great. But when you take cheap shots, players know that stuff. And it's not as easy to like maintain a good relationship when you do that. So if I'm going to be critical of somebody, a lot of times I stick to stat lines. And yeah, okay, look, it's boring. I'm not going to pretend like but at the same time, I know I'm going to be able to get that guy down the road when he's had a tough game or a great game. And he's not going to sit there and have any animosity towards me, because what I do is balanced. And that's really the key, is staying balanced. And
let me cut in here, because I want to give like a really good example of something that I think is important, because you mentioned about taking cheap shots. The late, great Pedro Gomez, one of the great human beings, great reporters. I'll never forget something he did. I was covering the Giants at the time, and we were in Arizona to play the Diamondbacks. And Pedro had written a very critical column about Buck Showalter, who at the time was the Diamondbacks manager, and basically said that Buck Showalter should be fired. And so Pedro wrote that. The next day it's in the paper. And the day that it's in the paper, Pedro was scheduled to fly to Los Angeles to go cover Arizona State or U of A. But he specifically took a later flight so that he could show up to the ballpark, so that if anybody had a problem with what he wrote, they could find him, that they didn't have to wait a week. So if you are going to write something negative about someone, if you are going to take a shot, if it's a fair shot, if it's an unfair shot, you sure as heck better be there the next day so that if someone has a problem, they can confront you one-on-one.
Absolutely. And that's about credibility. And I think that's the key. And it's funny, I did not know you were there for that, because I still remember that. And that's one of my favorite stories of all time. I was driving back from camping that day. It led to Bob Brenly getting the job a little bit after that. And they win the World Series the following year, I think it was. But look, you can't do this, especially in a game like baseball where it's 162 days and it can't all be hope and optimism. Like, spring training is a great time for hope and optimism. And then the season starts and then reality comes in and you have to be critical. You can't soft pedal stuff. If a guy sucks, got to write about it. And if a guy's going great, you can write about that. But the key is finding that level of being fair so that they respect you. And you know, one thing that I like doing, I will talk to guys about other stuff off the field all the time, about their families, about their interests, stuff like that. And one reason to do that is so you keep the conversation going. It's not always business when you're showing up. And some guys prefer it to be only business. Some guys will keep you at arm's length. Keep the conversation going so that, one, when you show up to talk to them after that terrible game, it's not the first time you're talking to them and you're talking to them cold and you have no rapport with them whatsoever. Because it's a hell of a lot easier to ask questions about a blown save if you've talked to that pitcher two times that week. And I like to make up for it. If a guy blows a save, I try to go back the next time they get a save, because any relief pitcher will tell you we only show up when they blow the save.
Yeah.
It's good to make up for it and go and when they get that save, because, you know, I bet you what, Trevor Hoffman had 600 plus saves. I bet you reporters talked to him somewhere around 50 times after a save, and the other 550, unless it was like some crazy situation, probably just went by the wayside just because that's how it works. But, you know, you just have to kind of go with the ebbs and flows and just try to be fair. And I think that's the best way to do it.
I remember when I first started as a baseball writer, and the late Nick Peters and John Shea and Henry Schulman and so many others who were critical in helping me learn about what it means to cover baseball. That one of the first things they actually said was, don't only talk to the closer when he blows a save. Make sure you talk to the closer even after he gets a save, even if it's one question. And I remember there was a time Rob Nin had blown a save. You know, the reporters are going over to talk to him. And somebody in the clubhouse goes, oh, yeah, you only talk to the closer when he blows a save. And to John Shea's credit, he stopped in his tracks. He turned around and looked at that player and he said, that's not true. And you know that's not true. You know, we talked to Rob Nin after saves. So I think that's very important. I also remember them giving me the advice of know when to put your notebook in your back pocket and just talk to somebody, and know when to have your notebook out and your pen and your recorder so that they know that you're on the record, but also know there's times to be off the record and you just got to know you can't always be off the record, but just knowing when is the right time to do those things.
Yeah. And I will just flat out say we can talk off the record, because now with phones as it is, that's your recorder and your primary recording device.
Right.
It's funny. I will actually say, hey, we're going to go off the record here, but record it so I can just remember it. Like, because there's value in listening to that conversation over again for perspective. But unless it's, I don't ever want to have an instance where I forgot that I wrote something in my off the record notebook. It's still good to keep an eye or remember what was said at all times. And yeah, just talking, just creating conversation leads to, especially even in off the record situations or background situation, leads to some of your best ideas, I think, because somebody will bring it up and they know they're not talking on the record about it and they can be free about it. And then, oh man, that's a really good idea. Maybe I should go. And then you bring it to somebody else on the record and say, hey, this is something that I heard. And damn if you don't have a great story. And then the best part is that when you have a great story and you have like three or four guys that have talked about it, you can go back to that original guy who talked about it off the record and say, look, I know we talked about this off the record the other day, but I'd love to like go back. And then they can sort through what they would want to say about it on the record. It's a easy way to, you know, again, just keep talking and get ideas, because when you do this, and I probably only do about 110 games a year, but even in 110 games a year, you know, you probably have good ideas from the game about 30 times, maybe 40,
right?
And the other 70.
Yeah.
There's a struggle. It's real. They call baseball a grind. It's a grind for everybody, and it's real.
It's time for a quick break from this week's podcast. I'm Amy J. Smith from the class of 98, and I'm a voiceover artist based in Los Angeles. I'm available for film narration, radio and TV commercials, documentaries, how-to explainer videos, and much more. You can contact me at amyvo.com. And now, back to this week's podcast. Here's Josh.
Let me ask you about the work-life balance of covering sports, but in particular baseball, since you're talking about the grind. And I don't want to make a lot of this conversation doom and gloom for prospective students who want to cover baseball, but I think it's important that they understand it. They need to know how the sausage gets made. It's really hard to have a work-life balance. We initially wanted to record this podcast a long time before we did, but right when we started, you got news that Carlos Correa was about to sign with the Twins, and so you had to stop. I know that there's been many times that I've been at the movie theater, I've been at the grocery store, I decided, hey, I'm going to step away for an hour, and I'm going to go to a yoga class. I'm going to do like some mental health for myself, some self-care. And during that time, something happens. Yeah. So what is your advice? What is your perspective on understanding that news happens all the time, especially in sports? A lot of it happens on weekends and late at night.
Yeah. Get ready to wear it, basically. That's it. I mean, that's the advice. If you want to do this, you know, I live in the Midwest now, and best time is the summertime here by far. You get 5 months of good weather. Well, my job takes up Friday and Saturday and Sunday all the time in the middle of summer. So when people are going to their cabins in the lake, I'm going to the ballpark. And like, that's something you just have to get used to, is that there are sacrifices. I'm lucky again that I work at The Athletic. 110 games is where I max out at, and I am as far away for those 52 games that I'm off, and I schedule, and I can look, there's times you cannot get away. Like if it's a big series coming up, absolutely. It's impossible to skip some things.
Trading deadline. Can't miss that. Can't miss the winter meetings.
Right. Exactly. But you can schedule around a lot of it. And I've found a way to do that. And I have a better work-life balance, you know, the last 2 or 3 years than I've ever had in my life. There was no trading early on, and especially when I was at a daily newspaper. And if you're going to be a daily newspaper, you know, some of my friends, like a horror story sort of, in the 2015 season, my friend Andy McCullough was working for the Kansas City Star. I think he worked 145 of 162 games, and they made a playoff and World Series run. And they won it all. So he basically worked every day from February 15th, when we go to spring training, through end of October. And there are very few breaks. He didn't have a backup. There's going to be times where that's a possibility. And you really have to be dedicated and know that you're going to work at 3 or 3:30 and probably not getting out till midnight. And it takes a lot of persistence. And I can understand why people stick with this a couple of years and move on. If I had the same schedule I had when I first got this job, there's no way I would be doing this now. But, you know, 110 games a year, I've figured out a pretty good way to enjoy my time off and get time off. But it has taken a long time to get here.
All right. I can say this because we're friends, but cry me a river, bro, because I do all 150 games for the Albuquerque Isotopes. I work solo. I set up my equipment. I don't have analyst. I don't have a fill-in. I work travel. No.
Hey,
I don't miss a pitch, bro.
Yes, but you also signed up for it.
And, this is true.
It's you also get to leave the ballpark within an hour of the final out if you want.
That's true. Sometimes our 25 job minutes.
Keeps us there. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Ours keeps us there 2-3 hours after games, you know, especially with no deadlines on the internet. So you were, I don't know. Sometimes, you know, the players get there so much earlier than us. They get to go home afterwards. They put in long days. I don't know whose schedule I'd want. It is all trade-offs, but yes, I know you get to actually, like, I go to like 15 concerts a summer. And I'm like, hey, Sush, I'm at this show today. And you're like, oh, I'm in, I don't know. What's your worst?
Oklahoma City.
Yes.
Oklahoma City. All right. Let's rewind. I think it's also important for a lot of different people, especially students, to know that, you know, Dan is not a guy who went straight from high school senior to journalism major at age 18 as a freshman. You took a different path. It took a while before you figured out that you wanted to be a journalist. So when you reflect on that, tell us about just your journey of how you found your way to journalism.
Okay, so I'll go quick version. In my second sophomore year, I was at 9 units. I needed 3 more to stay on my parents' health plan. I took a journalism class. I showed up. This was in, you know, Santa Rosa Junior College. And I thought, oh, it's probably like a, I don't know. I had no idea what the class was. We showed up the first day and it was one of my best friends from high school was in the class with me. And the professor was like, all right, welcome to the staff of the Oak Leaf. And I was stunned. I was like, wait a minute, I'm now writing for the paper because I've never written before. I didn't realize how lowbrow a junior college once a week. It was very easy. It's not like they were expecting award-winning stuff there. At the same time, like I'm already thinking and freaking out about what kind of content I was producing. This was, you know, a long time ago. But from there, I got an internship. Like I did well enough with the sports editor that I had an internship at the Santa Rosa Press Democrat. And that was a great foundational experience for me. Before I even got to San Diego State, I had worked 14 months at a daily newspaper, taking phone calls, being the agate guy. So many things that I learned while occasionally getting to do high school football and high school basketball games and getting constructive criticism from editors who were full-time and relentless and shredding apart my copy and doing stuff. Like, it's funny because I remember one in particular, he would turn like a 700 word story into 500 so easily. And like you learn, it's really tough to sit there and see someone do it. But if you take it the right way, you learn a lot of tricks real quick. I mean, it was an outstanding experience for me. And so I get to San Diego and join the Daily Aztec staff. And I had actually chosen to do the Daily Aztec staff because by the time I got there, I was 22. I remember I went to the Union Tribune for an interview. And I talked to Jess Kearney, who's like an all-time great at the Union Tribune. And my former assistant sports editor in Santa Rosa had worked at the Union Tribune and set me up. And I go in there and I've just moved to San Diego, first time out of my parents' house. And they're like, hey, you know, I think we have a position for you. We'd love you to come work here. It's 4 to midnight on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And the first thing I thought was, oh my God, I just moved out of my parents' house and I'm just going to go to college and work. And I was like, I made up an excuse. Like I thought that the workload of college was going to be too much and I didn't take the position and I just went with Daily Aztec. And it's really funny because I may have cost myself a future job opportunity at the Union Tribune, although I don't necessarily think I did because I got freelance with them right out of college anyways, or even before. But like choosing the Daily Aztec was by far the best experience of my life because I became so much more involved with the school. I got a real San Diego State education as opposed to I spent far more time on campus going to events. It made my college experience that much better than if I had just, it would have been like going to a commuter school, essentially. You know, you go to class and do your 12 units and then you go to your full, your 24 hour a week job. And I just think that I made the right choice for me at the time because I had my previous newspaper experience. You know, from there, I got a job at Vallejo about 8 months after I graduated. You know, I was freelancing for the Union Tribune. When I graduated, I was doing a lot of prep basketball, prep baseball. I was working full-time at a bank as a teller in San Diego, like just trying to stay in journalism how I could, which was freelance, but also get paid and, you know, be able to pay bills essentially. And so I kind of did that for 8 months. I got a job at Vallejo as a prep writer in 2003. I did that for 18 months. Then I went to the North County Times to become a community sports writer, which is lower than low on the totem pole, but they were like giving me a $5,000 raise over Vallejo. And you got to do preps on the weekends and occasionally help out on bigger assignments. Like I think I did a Chargers playoff game within 2 months of being there. Like I did a Chargers playoff game and I freelanced it for the Miami Herald because they needed somebody. And like, it was like, okay, this is what I really want to do this for. And So I was sort of the general assignment guy at the North County Times then for 2 years. And then the Little League World Series team happens. And like I'd picked up this team, Rancho Buena Vista, and I was bored. And so I started covering a Little League tournament at like the local level. Like it was All-Stars and it was the first round. So I was like, all right, cool. Why don't I do this? It's San Diego. There's got to be a shot that somebody's good here. And I went to cover Mount Carmel Ranch or Carmel Mountain Ranch. And they were supposed to be good. And they just got smoked by this team from Rancho Buena Vista. And it was their backup pitcher that had killed this team. And I was like, oh boy, this team might be good. And they killed everybody in the tournament. And so I followed them to their next tournament, which was, you know, 10 minutes away. They killed everybody in that next tournament. And like all of a sudden I'm in San Bernardino, then I'm in Williamsport. And I went from, you know, being the general assignment reporter, community sports reporter on page C7 to all of a sudden I'm on C1 writing game stories from Williamsport and notebooks. And then A1 was taking features from me. From there, basically everything kind of took off. I became a general assignment reporter more so. Like they gave me all the cool stuff. Like I did something on mixed martial arts when that was taking off, and I became our NASCAR guy. And like eventually the Padre beat opened up because the guy who was covering them, his wife was going to have a kid and he didn't want to do that anymore. And so all of a sudden I'm the Padre guy, and it's now 17 years later from that now. And it's crazy because I was just willing to take whatever they were throwing at me and saying yes, showing that I could do it with passion, because I figured like if I was doing the crappy stuff with passion, that when I finally got to something I wanted to do, like baseball or football, that it was going to be evident that I was a good reporter. So that was there's a lot that goes on in 20 something years.
I was about to say again, because we're friends, I can say this. Dan said, well, I'll give you the short version. Then he talked for 10 minutes nonstop about his path, but it was really good. And, you know, I think especially for a lot of students, you know, like how do I get started? And you use the word freelance, you know, I freelance for Miami or I freelance that. I will definitely briefly tell a story. And that was, I remember San Diego State was playing Navy in football. And I remember thinking it was a late Saturday night. And I thought, there is no way in the world that the newspapers from Washington, D.C. are going to send somebody to San Diego between the time zone difference and how it's starting, because it's just not going to get in the Sunday paper. So maybe they just want someone local who will do the game instead of flying somebody out. So I don't think email even existed. Somehow I got the number for the Washington Post sports department, and I called the sports editor, told him who I was. And he said, yes, he said, that'd be great. We'd love to have you cover this Navy San Diego State game. I'll never forget. I still have the stub to this day. I got paid $75 from the Washington Post to cover this San Diego State Navy football game. And it's like this light bulb went off in my head. And I remember just thinking, every time that someone comes to San Diego, I can do the same thing. And the Washington Post ended up using me for a handful of other stories. That was the year the Chargers went to the Super Bowl. I remember I did a playoff game for them. They asked me to do a feature on Junior Seau. There's a couple of other stories that I did for them. Like once they know that they can trust you, I kind of became their quasi San Diego person. And so if you're looking for freelance, just look at the roster of who's on the team. Every single one of those players is from somewhere, and their hometown paper might want a story about them, but they may not want to fly somebody out. I remember when I covered the Giants, Jerome Williams was from Honolulu. I knew that the Honolulu newspaper didn't want to send somebody out to San Francisco to write about Jerome, but it was a big deal. And they loved having stories about Jerome. So I did a couple of feature stories about Jerome Williams. And the sports editor at Honolulu loved it. You know, they had a little bit of a budget to do that. So looking for those ways, number one, it's a way to get yourself some cool feature stories, some different bylines to raise your profile. It gives you a little bit of extra money. And it's just a way of when you constantly think of the idea, I know that I found it really rewarding as a way to do some freelance work.
Oh, yeah. And you do get to do some of the coolest stuff. Like my freelance now is mostly based on Kenta Maeda, and it's translated into Japanese. And like I write for a Japanese publication, and even still get to do that kind of stuff. And there are definite avenues through freelance, because Vallejo saw that I was working for the Union Tribune as a freelancer, and they thought, oh, that's great. You know, like I'd done 3 or 4 months, and they saw it and they were like, that's a big paper. And that got me an interview. And once I got the interview, I was in the door, and it worked out really well. But I mean, like, always freelance leads to good opportunities, even if you're doing it just for like prep football. You know, I mean, there's nothing better than to put yourself on deadline where you have to be self-sufficient. You get the stats. It's a really hard thing to do, but like, you're standing by the coach, essentially right by the yard markers, and writing down those stats, because if you don't have it, nobody's going to tell you. And you're relying on 16-year-olds who are bumping up their friends' stats. And all of a sudden the kid has 225 yards rushing when really he had about 185.
Right.
But it's critical just for testing yourself on deadline, because that game ends at 9:30 and you have to turn around a 500-word story in 45 minutes and like get it into the paper, and constantly doing that and writing. I mean, honestly, that's the key to it all, is just writing and practicing and getting better.
I think it's really important when you get to a level of covering Major League Baseball of just feeling comfortable in the press box, feeling comfortable in the locker room. And so there's just getting there and kind of seeing how it works. So this is my segue into you telling the story of how we met. But this is a really good example of networking and finding a way to get to the ballpark any way as means possible, so that you can start to just learn through osmosis.
Yeah. You wrote a book, and me and Mike Klitzing,
who you were at the Daily Aztec at the time.
Yep. We're at the Daily Aztec time. Mike now works on campus. We noticed that you'd written a book about Barry Bonds, and both of us grew up big Giants fans. And we thought, boy, wouldn't it be cool to go interview Josh at AT&T Park, which was in its first year, I believe. I think that was, maybe that was year two, but you got us credentialed. And we came on the second day, because you said opening day was stupid, which is true. Opening day is the worst day to try and do stuff. But we showed up, and you know, Matt Hodson, who I now work with the Twins, got us credentialed, and we interviewed you in the second club level, I think. Basically wrote a review of the Barry Bonds book for the Daily Aztec. And it's funny how that works out, because I think later that year, that was the year the Giants took off. That was 02. That was on spring break, and Mike and I were both home. And so we met at AT&T, and it was really cool to go and do that and like get into the clubhouse and just see what, you know, the reporter life was like a little bit. It was really cool just to kind of see what it was like to see one of your peers and somebody who'd come through Daily Aztec, you know, a couple of years before, what you got to do. And it really made that possibility seem real. You know what I mean? Like, this is someone that went to my school, and here he is, he's written a book, and it helped bring that path to light. And we just kept being friends. And it's crazy how these things kind of come about, because, you know, 6 years later, I'm in the press box and doing Padre coverage. And were you the A's then?
I don't know. You started to ramble once again, that I lost track of where you went from this.
I know.
The point of this story that Dan mostly told effectively here is find a way to get to a ballpark, find a way to get to a soccer pitch, find a way to get to a football stadium, however means necessary to get a credential. While you're there, watch what the other reporters do, fake it till you make it, and just start to get comfortable. And this is what it means to be a reporter. This is what it means to sit in the press box. This is what it means to not be a fanboy. This is what it means to go into the clubhouse and work the clubhouse. When the scrum goes one way, it's okay, sometimes a whole lot better, if you go the other way and get somebody one-on-one while the pack moves from player to player. It's harder to do nowadays the way the clubhouses are set up, but that's the point of Dan's story.
Yeah, and even when I got to Vallejo and we were preps, and we got to go to A's, Raiders, Niners, Giants, Warriors occasionally, especially early on, that was where I basically would try to find the big reporter or two in the box and just follow them and just watch, because you learn so much that way. And that was huge for me early on. I remember being at a Giants game right after Sidney Ponson had gotten traded to them. And it was a huge trade at the time. It didn't work out so well. But I remember talking to Tim Kawakami after the game, just listening to his thoughts and the way he kind of worked the room. It was kind of foundational stuff for me, like just getting a sense of how to operate. And, you know, now I try to pass that stuff on when there's new rookie reporters, and the clubhouse has gotten so much younger the last couple of years, with people who are probably 22 to 25 and they're getting onto major league beats at such an earlier age than I could have done it. And so I try to pass along some of the stuff and not do it in a overbearing way. But I mean, it's good when the reporters are around you are good. When you have a better beat, it leads to intelligent conversation with players. You don't want people who are foolish around that kill the momentum of interviews and stuff like that. So it's always good to learn and you know, watch people who've done it for a while.
You just reminded me of a good story that I want to share. I'm pretty sure it was the first time that I ever covered a game just as a fill-in. And I was covering high school sports and youth sports as well. I was covering a lot of youth Oakland baseball sports. And Bip Roberts was on the A's at the time. This was in the late 90s. And I knew that Bip was from Oakland. And I went up to Bip and just started talking to him about this youth coverage, which was my primary responsibility. And I don't know, sometimes it's a friendly face in the clubhouse that kind of makes you feel comfortable. And ended up getting Bip Roberts's perspective on what these youth kids were doing. And that became a big deal to have a major leaguer talking about how he knew what was going on. And he was actually reading my stories. That's when it kind of set in, like, wow, Bip Roberts is reading the Oakland Tribune. He's reading my stories about this Oakland youth baseball team. And now I'm talking to him about how proud he is of them and his memories of playing there. And then that actually led to Bip getting in touch with some of the coaches who he had grown up with. That was his final year as a player. The next year, he ended up volunteering at a high school in Oakland and later became a head coach of a high school baseball team in Oakland. He's now an analyst and does a lot of work for the Oakland A's. And sometimes it's just a matter of just finding that first person in the clubhouse where you just feel comfortable. And then every time I'd go up to Bip, he'd say, like, hey, how's the under 13 team doing? How's the under 15 team doing? And how that just kept leading to more and more stories and just began with a, hey, Bip, I don't know if you've heard about, you know, these guys that are from the same hometown as you, but they're doing really well. And that led to all these different stories down the line. And I think that just points to talking to people and just seeing where the conversation goes.
You know, one thing I've learned is I like to joke and be a little bit dumb intentionally because it's disarming. And I think that I'll even announce it sometime to a player, and the ones who like you, I'll be like, hey, I'm this might be a dumb question. And then you get the response, well, that's all we expect from you, Dan. You know, like, but it leads to some good stuff. And I don't, especially when it comes to baseball, I was a terrible baseball player. I mean, like, I was a horrible, horrible baseball player. And I don't have the experience a lot of these guys have. And a lot of times I will ask them, basically just go to their expertise, you know, ask them to use their expertise as players to explain something. And when you do that kind of stuff, when you can meet someone on their level, it leads to good conversations, familiarity, and again, making me smarter, which I think, again, makes readers smarter. And when you're given access like this, your job is to, you know, provide context and, you know, expertise to your readers because you have access to it. And a lot of times I like to defer to the people who are the actual experts because I, you know, I've seen a ton of games, but I've never faced a 95 mile per hour fastball, never want to. And so I'm going to let Barry Bonds tell me what that's like and try to get it across as effectively to my readers as I can.
All right, let's wrap things up. One of the things we like to do on this podcast is brag about other people from San Diego State who are doing wonderful things in all different facets of communication. So you go first, brag about another Aztec who is making us proud.
I will go with my good buddy, Omar Ruiz, who was in my graduating class, but has worked for NFL Network as a reporter for a long time. It's been really cool to see him and his path because whereas I was the guy with the pen, he was the guy with the microphone all those years ago. And, you know, he's done it forever. And you can see it. I think a lot of his assignments are West Coast because he's West Coast based. But whatever the big game is on the West Coast that weekend, usually he is there on the sidelines. And it's great to see because there's so few people from my graduating class that are still in journalism. You know, maybe two or three are still in journalism. And so we're sort of the two warriors still left out there. And it's really cool to see him.
All right, way to go, Omar Ruiz. This week, I'm going to brag about John Shea. He's someone who I mentioned earlier in this podcast. Right now, he works for the San Francisco Chronicle. When I was a rookie beat writer in 2000, John was on the beat covering the Giants as well, and I learned so much from John. John went out of his way to help me in so many different ways about what hotels to stay at, and what time to arrive to the ballpark. And, you know, a lot of the different things that I've said about how if the pack goes one way, you go the opposite way. So you have something in your story that somebody else doesn't have, about having a notebook in your back pocket and knowing when to pull it out and knowing when to keep it there. I think that John also was really good at about teaching me. You know, I kind of wanted to saddle up to the 24th or 25th guy on the roster or the rookie, just because maybe it wasn't as intimidating and I'm looking for some type of story that's a little bit different. And John would just say, when in doubt, write about Barry Bonds. You can write about Barry Bonds every single day because that's what people want to read about. So when in doubt, write about the Stars, write about Barry Bonds every day. And John Shea's been, to this day, I still consider him a mentor. He wrote a best-selling book about Willie Mays. It's called 24. And he's just a consummate journalist. And I'm just really grateful that I got to be around John Shea at an early time in my career when I could really learn right from wrong. And so shout out to John Shea, a proud Aztec, another Daily Aztec alum.
Yep. Every time we're at the winter meetings, we talk San Diego State basketball or football, whatever is going well. Shea's a good dude.
Well, Dan Hayes, you're a good dude too. Appreciate you joining us this week. Thanks for all of your insights. I think there's a lot of really good things that student journalists can learn, even adult journalists can learn about what it's like covering baseball. You're not just a fan. You can't be a fan. You have to just be a journalist and do the job. Thank you, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me on. This was fun.
Once again, that's Dan Hayes, 17 years covering Major League Baseball for three different organizations, three totally different ways of covering baseball. That's going to do it for this week of Where You At. Friendly reminder, get involved in the department. You can mentor. You can talk to students via Zoom. You can go to classrooms. We'll always take your money. You can help out with the facilities at the Journalism Media Studies Department. Mentor, give back. Think about those who helped you and give back. And if you're a student, find someone who is doing what you want to do. Find a way to reach out to them. Do what Dan Hayes did to me. Contact me. See if you can get out to a ballpark and learn what it's like to do the job. Once again, my name is Josh Sushan. I'm your host, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks for listening to the Where You At podcast. This is Amy J. Smith from the class of 98. Thanks to Martine Marine for creating the music you're hearing right now, and Alex Piscatelli for her work on the podcast name and the artwork on social media. And a reminder to SDSU alums, we really want to know, where are you at? Tell us about your career. Get involved in the department. You can donate your time or your money. You can mentor students. You can speak in the classroom, in person or Zoom. You can provide internship opportunities to students. Help us grow the department. Again, thanks for listening. Subscribe to this podcast. Tell your friends. Recommend us a future guest. And go Aztecs!